and welcome to the President's Podcast of the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association, also known as the TCYLA. My name is Austin Gardner, and I am the current president of the TCYLA. The goal of this podcast is to discuss all things legal in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. Today's topic is for the series, Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. Today, I'm joined by my guest, Cody Kofer, for the topic of controlling the case narrative. Cody Kofer is from East Texas. He received his BA from Baylor University and went to Texas Tech to get his JD and MBA. While at Tech, he met his future wife, Erin. They shared a study corral in the library, and Cody gained trial experience as a prosecutor in Henderson County with the invaluable mentorship of the first assistant, Sam Hicks. After marrying Erin and moving to Fort Worth, he went into private practice handling criminal and family law cases. A few years later, he joined the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Northern District of Texas. He is now in private practice defending the accused in state and federal court. He's an adjunct professor at Texas A&M School of Law, and he has been board certified in criminal law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization since 2013. He is most excited about his newest position as the assistant coach for the Mariners T-ball team. Cody Kofer, thank you for joining our podcast.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me on. I've listened to your other episodes, and I am following some really great guests. It's kind of intimidating, but I'm honored to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And you're right. We've had a lot of good guests, and you are definitely in that mix. So first question. Right off the bat, what is your favorite thing to do when you were growing up in East Texas?
I love to fish. Where I would go visit my grandparents, either set of grandparents, there was a small tank close by. So I would hop the fence and get over there and wet a line. And in those little tanks, you never know what you're going to get, whether it's a catfish, bass, turtle, whatever. So that was one of my favorite things to do.
You know, it's like Ron Swanson says, fishing relaxes me. It's like yoga, but you get to kill something. So so I guess my next question is, why criminal law?
So criminal law is the opposite of what I told everyone I wanted to do when I was in law school. I would interview for jobs or talk to career services and say, I want to do anything but criminal law or family law. I ended up doing both. So I needed a job straight out of law school. And some friends of mine had a firm in Lubbock, but one of the partners moved back to East Texas because he had to deal with some family issues and they needed help in East Texas. So I agreed to go out there and help him at his firm in Gun Barrel City. The arrangement we had, I worked for him for a certain salary and some other benefits, and then I could also keep any money I made from taking court appointments in criminal cases. And in a lot of rural counties, you can get court appointments with really a note from your mother. You don't have to have a lot of qualifications. And so I started taking court appointments in the surrounding counties and found it to be a lot of fun. But more than anything, my girlfriend at the time, Erin, she was a prosecutor and she was trying cases. She was in Denton first and then Tarrant County. And I was so envious because I wanted to try cases. I did mock trial throughout law school. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I just didn't know that how you do that is becoming a criminal law attorney. So I decided I wanted to be a prosecutor. And I went to Sam Hicks that you mentioned in the introduction or the bio and got some advice from him, asked if he'd be a reference on my resume. We sat down and talked for a couple of hours in the courthouse that day. He called me the very next day and said, you know, can you talk? I closed my door, said, Donnie is, he's quitting. He gave us 2 weeks notice. You can have his job if you want it. So I walked down the hall and gave my 2 weeks notice. And 2 weeks later, I was a prosecutor in the Henderson County Attorney's Office.
And after that, you kind of ran your own criminal defense law firm for some years, and then you kind of pivoted to the Federal Public Defender's Office. Talk us through the process of how you made that decision.
So I started my own practice, you know, with about $1,200, like a tax refund of about $1,200. So I was not well capitalized starting out, but I was very lucky and I had some good mentors, some good people that came along to work with me. And I grew a busy practice that was running well enough to support, you know, me and my family, but it was sort of unwieldy. And I was in a tough headspace. I was having some struggles with, you know, mental health and just kind of keeping everything going. And I took an inventory. One of my associates that had worked for me for some time told me, you know, she needed to make more money. So she was looking for other opportunities, and I would have paid her more money. She was worth everything that she could get, but it just really wasn't in the budget. But that sort of gave me license to really consider other opportunities also. And so I, at that point, had started handling some federal cases and had some success. The Federal Public Defender's Office had a position opening up, and they were looking specifically for somebody that had experience, trial experience, but also experience in our local federal courts. And I fit the bill and I went in. It was a very friendly interview process. Someone recommended to me that I should join the defender's office. And so I went in and they made the offer. And so I quickly went into wrap-up mode for my practice. The motivation at the time was, you know, I knew that running my practice was taking too much of a toll on me and my family, and I needed the space to sort of figure some things out. But also, I knew that there was a lot more that I could learn and that I could grow a lot more in, especially in the arena of federal criminal defense. So it was a wonderful opportunity. I learned a tremendous amount and sort of righted the ship also.
Yeah. And, you know, I've never owned my own law firm. I've worked for a very small law firm. And then now, of course, I've been working with the district attorney's office for Tarrant County for just in my 5-year mark. And I can't imagine the stress. Also, you know, I'm sure you have high highs and low lows. You know, you get the benefit of and thrill of being your own boss and stuff like that. But there has to be some kind of, obviously, the stress of running your own business, and what does a work-life balance look like? So if other people were in their own firm and were struggling, whether it be financially or work-life balance or any other personal reasons, and they're considering, you know, shifting or shutting their doors and changing careers, what advice would you give them?
If you are running your own practice and you are considering shutting it down, then that is an option that you really need to give serious consideration to, because running your own practice, you need to be fully committed to the practice. And once you get that little seed in your mind about how nice it would be to not have to worry about, you know, rainmaking and making payroll and dealing with staffing issues, all of that, once that seed gets planted in your mind, it really grows fast and starts to bust apart your resolve in running your own practice. So the first thing I would say is fully explore that idea and come to a definite resolution on it, whether you are indeed going to shutter your practice or you are going to look for other opportunities. But you need to answer that question. You can't just have it floating out there. The other thing is you need to look at your life as a whole. All the spheres of your life, your family, your social life, your religious or spiritual life, your physical health, all of that. And you need to see how your practice or your career fits into that and affects all of it, because it's all interconnected. And a lot of times whenever you're in the hustle of trying to grow a practice, it's very myopic. It's all about the practice. And so it is hard to step back. I was fortunate because, you know, my wife knows me even better, I think, than I know myself. And so she was able to provide very wise counsel and do it in a way that was encouraging and supportive and, you know, didn't emasculate me or diminish my own decisions, but nonetheless steered me in the right direction.
Now, even though you went to the public defender's office, you were still practicing essentially in the same area, really the exact same area of law, criminal defense. How would you describe being a federal public defender was different from a private criminal defense attorney?
So when you're in the defender's office, you're only handling federal cases. One of the things I did miss about private practice was handling state and federal. If you have 100% federal cases and you're doing 100% indigent defense, it's frankly demoralizing. There are certainly people that are wired in a way that they thrive in that circumstance. I found that ultimately I was not. It was really taking a toll on me. Also, you're working in the federal government. You're surrounded by warriors. You're surrounded by some of the best lawyers practicing, but you're still inside of this behemoth machine. And so you have all of the bureaucracy and the arcane record keeping, all that sort of thing, that really just drags down your day to day. And so in some ways, that can be liberating for people. And it was early on for me because I didn't have to think about how I was going to keep time, what software I was going to use, when I needed to be at work or anything like that.
Sure.
It can be liberating in a way. But I'm not wired to stay in that circumstance, I think, long term, or at least not at this stage of my life.
You became board certified in 2013. Explain to those who may not know what is board certification and how you become board certified.
In Texas, the state bar is pretty particular about designating attorneys as experts in particular fields. Board certification is, for the most part, how the state bar identifies people that are experts in a particular field. And so you have to practice a certain amount of time, 5 years. And so I became board certified at the earliest opportunity. You have to have objective actions, such as for criminal law, you have to have tried so many cases of a certain level of seriousness. You have to have done a certain number of appeals or other specific objective requirements for the practice of criminal law. You have to get references from attorneys and from judges that you've practiced with or before. You have to do all this, and then you submit your application, and then you have to take an exam. So assuming you make it through the application process, then you have to take an exam. And I'll tell you, the exam is more difficult than the bar exam as far as substance goes. It's not more difficult in the sense that you're not as stressed about it. It is something that you deal with every day. But as far as just the difficulty of the questions, it was my experience that it was more difficult than the bar exam. I didn't lose as much sleep, so don't let that scare anybody. But, you know, it was a way I was getting a lot of great experience thanks to the charity of a lot of mentors and the trust of a lot of clients. But it was a marker being a young attorney. I knew that I was great. I knew that I was very good. Right. But I was searching for an objective marker to say to everybody else, hey, look, I'm something different. I'm something special. And the board certification gave me a rubric and an avenue to be disciplined and do that.
And not only do you have to do all the studying, but you have to have like a certain number of trials and things like that. I mean, it's like, I can understand why you say that it's not stressful, because at the end of the day, if you fail the exam or whatever the case may be, the only thing you're out of is time and $750, right? You're still a lawyer, still practicing the same area of law. No one has to know, I guess, that you failed the exam, but it definitely gets in. I could see how it's harder because it really dives into the minutiae that you're just not dealing with on an everyday basis.
And I enjoyed studying, and studying was, it was fun for me. First of all, I love to nerd out on criminal law.
Yeah.
The other thing I had not practiced any federal criminal law at that point. And so I had to learn that for board certification. And that was what changed the trajectory of my career altogether, because I went through and learned this new area of law. And I describe federal criminal practice to people that don't do it. It is as similar to state criminal practice as probate is to state criminal practice. It's a completely different area of law. And so learning, or at least I thought I learned some federal law, and that's what, you know, empowered me to go and start taking federal cases, which led, of course, to going to the defender's office. And so far, a lot of history.
Yeah. So like a lot of the lawyers that I know, you are married to another lawyer who actually serves as a magistrate judge here in Tarrant County. What would you say the pros and cons are of being married to another attorney? And do you object during marital disagreements?
There are no cons that I can think of. That
I'm sure Aaron will be listening to this. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Like, she'd have a lot of cons, not probably about being married to a lawyer, just being married to this lawyer. But so it's funny because people always ask about the arguing and that sort of thing. And the truth is, because we're both trial lawyers and we're committed to communication in the courtroom and then also in negotiations, that has been a tremendous help in our marriage, that we are both genuine in our communication. We're both, I think, skilled in communicating, and there's not a lot of maneuvering. We really try to boil things down. And so conflict resolution, it really is helpful. But the big thing that is amazing being married to another trial lawyer is the understanding of what you go through as a trial lawyer and knowing the ups and downs. You know, this is a specific example. I was sort of going through a gray period, sort of having the blues at some point several years ago in my career, and I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't really put my finger on what was wrong, but I knew it was. And Aaron immediately said, you haven't tried a case in almost 6 months, and you do this whenever you go a long period without being in trial, without the excitement of trial.
Yeah.
And she was just couldn't be any writer about it. So anyway, it's wonderful being married to a lawyer, but specifically a trial lawyer.
Yeah. It's always nice being married to smart people. And even though I'm not married to a lawyer, I'm married to someone who's very smart and probably smarter. No, she is smarter than me. So the smart decision I made was being married to her. So yeah, I can understand like the communication and just having that, knowing your partner to an intuitive level where you kind of see what's going on when they don't even know what's going on. Right.
I've had, students that find out, I mean, you know, listen to me talk about how great I am. And I mean, because I do have a hyperinflated ego.
Sure.
And so they'll ask, you know, the question, well, do you really think, I mean, do you think you're the best trial lawyer? Do you think you're the best criminal trial lawyer? And my response always, I'm not even the best trial lawyer that slept in my bed last night. And so it's not a joke. She's a better trial lawyer than me, but also having somebody just on the professional side, having someone to come home and talk through the work with is also really great.
Yeah. So during our last podcast with Christy Jack, she emphasized the importance of telling a story as a trial attorney. And this is kind of the crux of what we're here to discuss today. So in the cases that we're going to discuss, you'll discuss kind of controlling the narrative of the case, controlling the story of the case and why that's important. So if you can set up the first case we're here to discuss and explain how you control the narrative for your client.
This was a case that I tried in state court before going to the defender's office, and it changed my approach to trial in a lot of ways, but primarily in what we're discussing today, in taking control. Especially on the defense side, we often are reactive
we're dodging punches, and we're trying to minimize damage. So in this case, my client was accused of sexually abusing some young boys, and the prosecutor was a very accomplished prosecutor, a lot of experience, really great trial lawyer. He's now a defense attorney, really great defense attorney. And I knew I had my work cut out for me. Well, they were trying one of multiple alleged victims. And one of the issues in criminal defense is you have to be really careful if your client has other bad acts or crimes out there that aren't what your client is being tried for. So you're being tried for crime A, but you know there's evidence of crime B, C, and D. And a lot of attorneys, or we all have to worry about whether that evidence of B, C, and D is going to come in. And there are certain things you can do that clears the way for the prosecutor to get that evidence in. So in the defense, now we didn't have a really great guilt innocence defense. And I'll just say that because that does shape your strategy.
Sure.
But any defensive theory that I came up with, particularly alibi, we had some good alibi evidence, was going to, what we say, open the door, was going to pave the way for the prosecutor to put on evidence of crimes B, C, and D. And so I was wrestling with that issue. Like, it was either don't put on a defense or they're going to get this in. Well, once I decided, you know, I'm never one to not put on a defense. I've seen lawyers that basically just don't do anything, just like are dead fish in the courtroom because they're afraid of the extraneous evidence.
That, and, you know, they a lot, you know, knowing that the prosecution has a burden and just sitting there and be like, well, they didn't prove it, right?
Sure. And it's so rare that that, you know, works out if they have any kind of case solved. So in any event, you know, I had a defense and I wanted to put on my defense, but I knew it was going to bring in this evidence. And so I made the decision that if the evidence was going to come in, I was going to take control of it. Now, there's a little more complexity because I also understood the chances of guilt innocence victory in this case were not very good. And I knew that we were almost certainly going to make it to the second phase of the trial, which is the punishment phase. And so what informed the strategy is the jury finding out about crimes B, C, and D during the first phase instead of the second phase to try to sort of put some distance. But anyway, I made the decision. I said, you know what? If they're going to find out about it, I'm going to be the one that does it. So when they called their detective as the very first witness, I gave him my normal cross-examination, picked apart everything that he did, and then I transitioned into my second part of my cross, which was to talk to him and ask him about crimes B, C, and D. And the judge and the prosecutor and everyone was shocked and surprised because lawyers bend over backwards to not bring in the extraneous evidence, but since I knew it was coming in. And so I fashioned it into, and I think there, you know, I think there was absolutely evidence in support of this. You know, he was out there fishing for, this detective was sort of fishing for these other victims. And, you know, it may have well been that he suggested to some people that, you know, there was a good reason to identify themselves as victims in this case. Well, anyway, it shocked everybody. It allowed me to take control of the narrative as it related to these other alleged victims. And I really think it changed the outcome, ultimately the punishment in the case, but changed the outcome. We got a much, much better sentence than we ever could have reasonably expected.
Yeah. And did you feel a little more free since you essentially didn't have a good case for the guilt innocence portion to kind of free you up to make that decision and to pivot in a different way that most defense attorneys don't?
Yes.
I guess the better question is if there was a better case for guilt innocence, would you have done the same thing or would you have done something different?
I would have done the same thing because I had to put on a defense. I wasn't going to just sit and rely on the burden in this case or in most any case. And so it was really a matter of this evidence is going to come in. I knew it was. And I could fight like hell to keep it out. But the right thing for the judge to do would be to let the evidence in. And so that's part of it. You have to know your case and you have to know the law of your case.
Right.
And so once I knew that, once I crossed that threshold of knowing, hey, this evidence is going to come in, then it was a matter of how do I handle it? And that was the takeaway for me. How you handle it is you handle it. You take control of it. You tell the jury the first time they hear the evidence, they're going to hear it in the context of your questions, of your explanation in your narrative.
Now, when you have a case where, you know, the facts are a little more inflammatory, like sexual abuse of a child and things like that, does that also change your strategy at all as opposed to, I don't know, stealing a car or armed robbery?
Every case is unique and there are differences in how you try those inflammatory cases, or those more sensitive cases, allegations of sexual abuse. Regardless, though, you have to show the jury that you're not afraid of the facts. You're not afraid of the truth. And you're trying to show them what the real story is. And if you are playing a game where you're trying to keep things from the jury, or you're not engaged in giving them facts, you're not engaged in giving them the story, they see that for what it is. And so whether it's, you know, a shoplifting case or an aggravated sexual assault case, you cannot be afraid of the facts and you can't be afraid to take control.
You've probably talked to a lot of juries after a case, and has the trying to keep things out ever worked, or do you feel like juries are pretty intuitive and they kind of figure out that you're trying to keep things away from them?
If you're doing a good job of keeping things out, having evidence excluded or not opening the door, you're really having most of that fight outside the presence of the jury. Once this goes back to preparation, this goes back to knowing your case. You need to be pushing the judge to make those decisions pre-trial if you can, and on breaks if you can't do it before trial. So you're having those fights outside the presence of the jury. What you don't want is to be jumping up and objecting all the time, and the judge lets the evidence in, and the jury's like, well, he's trying to keep us from hearing this evidence. Now, don't take that to be advice that you should not object. You should be afraid to object, because I used to be that way. I used to not want to object in front of the jury, and I've completely changed my position on that also.
Yeah. So I believe there was another case regarding some exhibits that you wanted to control how they got in. If you could talk about that case and how you controlled the narrative in that one.
Tried this case over in Dallas in federal court, and the government had, I don't know how many exhibits, 100. Some of them were photographs. Some of them were video footage. And in this situation, the one of the co-defendants, who was this drug dealer, he had a DVR, he had a surveillance recording system in his trap room, like in the drug dealing room of the hotel, which was a terrible idea. Anyway, we had all these exhibits that were going to come in, and I knew what the government wanted to do with each of these exhibits. And I knew if the government got to put those up and tell the story the way they wanted to tell it, that we were going to be in big trouble. So that their first law enforcement witness was a task force officer that was not the lead. He was involved throughout the case, but he was certainly not the one that they wanted to put in all of their case through. He wasn't a very good witness for them. And so I decided that I was going to enter all of the government's exhibits through that witness. And so I wasn't sure how it was going to go. It sort of a burr rabbit situation. I grabbed me a couple of exhibits that were for sure better for me, that the government would identify as, oh, you know, I can see why the defense wants these exhibits in. And I started going through almost a play predicate for these exhibits. I knew this witness probably couldn't lay the predicate for a lot of them.
Right.
And so, but I was fumbling through. And then finally, the government's attorney objects, And it was kind of a half-hearted objection. He's like, well, if Mr. Kofor wants these exhibits in, and he's saying that they're authentic, then I think the rest of the government's exhibits 1 through 100 should also come in. And so I turned to the judge with a defeated look in my eye and say, okay, well, I think that seems fair, Judge. I'm going to move to admit governments 1 through 100. And she looked surprised. They looked surprised. And they're admitted. And so I go through this witness. And although he didn't have a lot of knowledge about it, I was able to ask him questions of what I thought Exhibit 1 showed and what I thought Exhibit 2 showed. And I, you know, and then there was a video, this is kind of disturbing, but a video of someone being tortured with a blowtorch. And the government had made a deal with the guy that was torturing the person with a blowtorch, had made a deal with that guy to try to convict my guy, who was just kind of someone that lived in the hotel. And, you know, they were going to see that video when the government put it on as, oh my God, look how awful this drug conspiracy is. It's disgusting. But whenever the first time they saw it was me showing it to them and showing how disgusting it was that the government was willing to make a deal with this guy.
Right.
So it really was a bomb that blew up in the courtroom, and it resulted in a hung jury in that case, where I think, you know, anyone that saw the evidence beforehand would have thought was a remarkable slam dunk for the government.
Yeah. And, you know, once those are admitted, I mean, you have the ability to really just hammer home some of the exhibits and what you think it is, because it's already admitted, right? It's in evidence. You can talk about it. You can publish it, versus, you know, obviously the government getting to tell the story first, you insert your own story, to make your own case and spin it as a narrative. Do you have any other cases that you felt controlled narrative?
All of my trials, I am looking for sort of pinch points or areas where I can wrest away control from the government and direct the case. That can be in smaller ways, you know, just in, you know, choosing to fight about certain issues at certain times in the trial that cause disruption. But, you know, another thing that sort of has evolved is my commitment to putting on a defense case. The first half of my career, I think maybe I called 2 witnesses in all of my trials in the defense case at guilt innocence. And now I've realized that jurors, although the government or the state has the burden, jurors expect us to put on some evidence on our side. And so I really put a lot of hustle and thought and imagination sometimes into putting together a defense case. Even if it's only on a couple of small points, I'm going to have some people get up there and give the jury something coming from us.
As we kind of talk about controlling these narratives, what is some of the best way you prepare to do that when you look at a case? And lastly, kind of a different question. What's some of the best advice you've gotten from mentors or other attorneys?
Whenever you're preparing a case, and Christy had a lot of great things to say about this, you have to have a story. You have to have a cohesive narrative. Jurors make an emotional decision, and then they sort of retcon or go back and make a rational decision to back up their emotion. So you have to have a story. And sometimes you will spend hours, maybe weeks off and on, figuring out certain parts of that story and how a particular piece of evidence fits into the story. So that's really the key to preparation, figuring out the story and then fleshing it out through your own investigation, through your own evidence. Don't rely on the government or the state. As far as advice that I've received, Abe Factor is one of my great mentors, and he's just been wonderful to me over the years, personally and professionally. I've tried several cases with him. Abe showed me some great advice, and he said something to the effect, but I've just seen it over and again for trial lawyers, especially on the defense side. You get in there, even in the hardest, toughest cases, and you just keep punching, you keep fighting, and something shakes loose in a lot of those cases. Sometimes it can be big enough to change the course of the case, but you just have to stay in the fight and be committed to fighting. And then some advice that jury consultant Robert Hirschhorn gives in a lot of his talks, and he and I aren't close, but it's something that I've seen him say in his talks, and it really resonates with me. If you want to be a better trial lawyer, then be a better husband. If you want to be a better trial lawyer, be a better father. If you want to be a better trial lawyer, be a better friend. And as I've gotten older, I've come to realize the wisdom in that advice. And specifically, I was thinking about it last night. My three-year-old, he asks why all the time. We're familiar with this. Anybody that has kids.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be frustrating and annoying, but I try real hard, and I fail, but I try real hard to engage him and my daughter when they have questions. Why is the sky blue? And forcing myself to answer those very fundamental basic questions and just unpack these basic ideas, I think is a great exercise for a professional communicator. And so I think Robert Hirschhorn's advice is wonderful advice for so many different reasons. But, you know, I've had the benefit, of wonderful mentors throughout my career and even today. I mean, I have really great mentors, and they make all the difference.
Yeah, if there's one theme that almost gets repeated in every one of these podcasts, is that having mentors is really a key to success. And Abe Factor is a good one. You know, you mentioned him. He's actually come to Texas A&M and spoken to students when I was a student and talked about the practice of law and being a criminal defense attorney or a trial attorney. So he's definitely one of the most active peoples in Tarrant County. Very, very, he's a mainstay. This has been Austin Gardner with the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association Presence Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to our series on, Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. We hope you subscribe to our podcast and join us for future episodes. I want to thank our guest, Cody Kofer, for joining us today. For more information on what is happening with our organization, please check out our website at www.tcyla.org and follow our Instagram account at Tarrant Young Lawyers. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on a brand new episode of the TCYLA Presence Podcast. Have a great day and make great decisions.